series of Qn, call that Qn hat, and you evaluate it at, there's something depending on the dimension that you should ignore. What's important here is that this K is multiplied by 1 over the square root of n, and you get a Gaussian. That 1 over the square root of n is this scaling of the lattice that I was talking about earlier. That's the way you should be thinking about that. And a more refined statement of the central limit theorem, the so-called local central limit theorem, says that asymptotically, Qn of x is given by some constant out in front times a Gaussian in x. And here you see that x squared has an n underneath it, and that's telling you again that the right scaling is 1 over the square root of n. This is just the end point. You can actually state a much stronger statement about convergence of random walk to Brownian motion, which involves convergence of measures on the space C01 of continuous functions on the interval 01, but I won't go into that in any detail. So this is all well understood. It's from, say, 50 years or more old. I want to put some interaction into the model now. And one very nice model is the self-avoiding walk. And this just takes all random walk paths on the... So let's think about the square lattice for the moment, but you could do it in any other number of dimensions, and you can do it on any lattice that you like. Take all of the random walk paths which never visit any site more than once, so that they're self-avoiding. That's what the self-avoiding means. You never visit any site more than once. And declare that all such paths of length n, starting at the origin, are equally likely. Here's what this looks like in simulations. This is much harder to simulate. And I got these pictures from Alan Sokol using a so-called pivot algorithm that he and Neil Madras spent some time in analyzing and developing. And there you have on the square lattice a self-avoiding walk, a random self-avoiding walk of length 100, a random self-avoiding walk of length 1,000, and a random self-avoiding walk of length 10,000. You may think that you see some self-intersections there, but if you brought your opera glasses, you could check and you'd see that they're just near misses and not actual intersections. And so this looks nothing at all like the picture that I had before up of Brownian motion. This is a very different kind of animal than what we saw for the scaling limit of random walk. And the problem is to describe the probability distribution of these paths. That's an interesting problem just when you look at this picture. That's something that's rather appealing. But there are a number of other good reasons for thinking about this problem. One of the first groups of researchers to study self-avoiding walk were the polymer chemists going back to the beginning of the first half, anyway, of the 20th century. And they take these self-avoiding walks rather seriously as a model of linear polymer molecules in a good solution. If you look at books like DeGene's book on scaling concepts in polymer physics, you'll see that chapter one is devoted largely to an analysis of this model. So they take it seriously there. It also shows up in statistical mechanics, which is how I got into it. It's quantitatively and qualitatively related to models like the Ising model of ferromagnetism. So there's a whole body of work in the physics literature which analyzes this model. Certainly also interesting from the point of view of combinatorics, because we're putting the uniform measure on the set of self-avoiding walks of length 10,000, which means that the probability of one of them is 1 over however many there are, and so you get into counting problems right away that turn out to be rather difficult and they're still unsolved. From the point of view of probability, it's also an appealing model because it's a little bit pathological. It's a very good example of something that's not a Markov chain. First of all, it's not Markov because in a Markov chain, what you do next depends only on where you are now and not how you got there. And this certainly is not like that because you have to avoid your entire past. But the worst thing is that it's not a stochastic process at all. It's not possible to define it in terms of transition probabilities. And a lot of the usual methods of probability don't give you anything on this. And so it's interesting from that point of view as well. So the goal is to construct the scaling limit, to write down a measure on paths, which reproduces this kind of pictures. And, well, that's pretty easy in one dimension because there's only two walks. You either go left or you go right, and that's the end of it. But in two and three and four dimensions, it's still unsolved in the way that I've stated it. In higher dimensions, d greater than or equal to 5, with Hara, we showed that the central limit theorem holds. and that the scaling limit is actually Brownian motion in higher dimensions. The only thing that changes from the scaling here, 1 over square root of n that I used for the random walk, is that there's this extra constant put in there, d, which it's necessary in order to get the Brownian motion. But basically, it's just Brownian motion in high dimensions. The proof of that, I'm going to say something more about the proof later on, but the proof is based on a technique called the Lace expansion, which is, as Ed said, it's something I learned from David Bridges, and it's based on, it was invented by David and Tom Spencer back in the early 80s, and it involves treating the self-avoiding walk as a small perturbation of simple random walk. Now, if you look at this picture, it's not a small perturbation of the simple random walk. You can just see that it doesn't look anything like the picture I showed you before. But above four dimensions, it turns out that it does. For d less than 4, we expect a non-Gaussian limit, something that doesn't have anything to do with Brownian motion. And one of the more exciting things that's happened in the last year or so in the field is that the limiting process, in other words, the law, the probability law that describes this kind of a picture, has been identified in some sense. At least there's a conjecture of Lawler, Schramm, and Werner that this limit is a process called the stochastic-Loebner equation with parameter 8 over 3. I'm not going to say what that is, but I just want to draw your attention to the fact that there has been some recent progress in the two-dimensional situation. You know, if you want to show that something is a scaling limit of self-avoiding walk, it's very useful to know what it is that you're trying to prove is actually the limit. You know, if you're trying to prove that something converges to something, it's nice to know what that something is on the other side. So this is really progress here, and they have good reasons to make that conjecture. The difference between dimensions below 4 and dimensions above 4 can be explained as follows. Well, 4 is equal to 2 plus 2. And that's really how you calculate that 4 is the relevant dimension. And the reason for that is that the Brownian motion paths are two-dimensional. They're jiggling enough that they have Hausdorff dimension 2. And two independent Brownian motions are not going to intersect each other generically. Well, they're not going to intersect each other at all if d is greater than or equal to 4. And so the idea is that two-dimensional objects generically are going to miss each other in more than four dimensions, in more than 2 plus 2 dimensions. And so you can come up with this figure 4 as being equal to 2 plus 2. Right. So that's the self-avoiding walk, and that's the end of my brief discussion of Brownian motion arising as a scaling limit. What I want to do now is to move on to models with branching, and show how super Brownian motion, which is a relative of Brownian motion that involves a lot of branching, see how that arises as a scaling limit. So the first example that I would like to talk about is lattice trees. Now, what's a lattice tree? You take bonds in the lattice. So think about ZD, and you construct a tree in the lattice out of the nearest neighbor bonds, just the little unit length intervals which join neighboring sites in the lattice. Just put those all, assemble those together in such a way that you have a tree sitting in the lattice, that is, no cycles. And let's pin things down and say that our trees should always contain the origin, and say that all trees of size n are equally likely. That's the probability measure that we'll put on, which is the right probability measure from the point of view of applications to branched polymers, where this is also taken seriously as a model of polymers. The goal is to construct the scaling limit, so that is, we'd like to consider larger and larger lattice trees, shrink the lattice down, and see what kind of random object emerges. And here's a picture of a 5,000-site lattice tree that was, again, created using something related to the pivot algorithm for self-avoiding walks, pivot algorithm for lattice trees. It's a picture from Jans van Rensburg in Madras, who were at York University. And this is a tree with a random tree, lattice tree, on the square lattice with 5,000 sites. So we're interested in trying to explain the probability law, the probability distribution of these kind of random objects. So that's the first model. I have two other models I want to explain or introduce before I start talking about any theorems or results. So the second model is percolation. Again, this is a model which is built out of the bonds in the lattice, I didn't say this before, but for the lattice trees and for percolation, I'm going to want to consider not just the nearest neighbor models where we use nearest neighbor bonds, but also allow, say, a bond potentially to be between any two sites which are separated by less than some distance L. These I'll call the spread out models, because I'm going to need a small parameter, which will be the reciprocal of L. So here, this is a nearest neighbor lattice tree, but you could also imagine constructing lattice trees from these larger set of bonds. Okay, so percolation we're going to talk about in either context here, but let me fix it for the moment just for the sake of definiteness to be the nearest neighbor model. You take all of these bonds in the lattice and you declare each bond independently to be occupied with some probability P and vacant with probability 1 minus P. And what we're interested in is the connected clusters of occupied bonds which show up in a typical configuration in this model. These look rather interesting. Actually, I don't have a picture of bond percolation here. I have a picture instead of site percolation on the square lattice, which shares many features with bond percolation. And for the kind of question that I'm asking, it's essentially identical. So what this is here sites are occupied with probability P and are vacant with probability 1 minus P. And you're seeing different values of P here. So this one in the corner is P equals 0.4. This is 0.5. This is 0.593. And this is 0.65. This is a simulation on a 510 by 510 lattice in a book with some nice pictures by Bunda and Haviland. And in these pictures, what's happening is that the connected clusters of sites are colored according to how big they are. And in this picture, there are lots and lots of little clusters. Here, there are some larger clusters, but they still tend to be small on the scale of the box that we're looking at. At this special value, 0.593, there's something rather dramatic happens. Here, there are these little small clusters. Now, suddenly, there are clusters which are spanning the box, or at least there's one cluster here which is spanning the box from top to bottom. And when P is equal to 0.65, there's basically one gigantic cluster which is eating everything up except for some little holes. So there's a phase transition that takes place here, and that's expressed in this sense. There exists a value PC, which is between 0 and 1, strictly, so that if P is less than PC, then the probability that there exists an infinite cluster, a connected cluster of occupied bonds somewhere in the infinite lattice, is 0. Whereas if P is greater than PC, the probability that there exists an infinite cluster somewhere in that lattice is going to be equal to 1. So something very dramatic happens as P goes from below PC to above PC, that suddenly this infinite cluster is just going to emerge spontaneously and instantaneously as P increases above PC. It's possible and desirable to put some orientation into this model, and there's a model oriented percolation. Here's a lower tech picture of oriented percolation. In oriented percolation, the sites in the lattice, the lattice itself is now ZT cross Z plus. So here you have in the horizontal direction ZD, and then another copy on top, and another copy on top. So you think of this as a time variable which is increasing. And now bonds that are potentially occupied or vacant are joining sites in one time slice with the sites in the time slice which is above it. And here I've drawn a picture in the spread out model of what a configuration might look like. This is the connected cluster of the origin that I'm focusing on, which would be the sites at the endpoints of those blue bonds there. So also in that model, there's a phase transition in exactly the same way that I just described for ordinary percolation. There's a value PC such that if P is below PC, no infinite cluster. If P is above PC, there exists an infinite cluster somewhere in the lattice. Now, what happens at PC? That's a natural question. It's known, it's a result of Zoudenhout and Grimmett, that at P equals PC, in the oriented context, there is no infinite cluster. For ordinary percolation, it's also true, but it's still an open problem to prove that it's true in general. Everybody believes that for ordinary percolation, there's no percolation at the critical point, no infinite cluster at the critical point, but it's proved only in two dimensions on the square lattice, actually. Well, there's some other lattices as well, but it's not proved for all two-dimensional lattices, but for some special ones, and for high dimensions, it's also proved. The goal is to study the scaling limit of these large clusters. So what we want to do is to study the scaling limit of these large clusters which are present at the critical point and understand what is the probability law of these objects. So this is sometimes referred to as studying the incipient infinite cluster, because there's this notion that at P equals PC, there are these large clusters which are kind of struggling to be infinite but not quite making it. And so there's something incipient about the infinite cluster which is present at P equals PC, and that's what it is that we'd like to study. See, I had one other picture here that I wanted to show you just to see how interesting these clusters look like at PC. They have a nice self-similarity structure. This is the typical kind of picture that you see in books on fractals. In this top corner, top left corner here, there's a box, which is a bit difficult to see on the screen, but there's a red box there, and then that is blown up, and then there's a box there which is blown up, and this box is blown up again. And this is a cluster at P equals PC, and you see that you can't really distinguish these pictures one from the other, so there's a nice self-similarity feature, and that's very appealing. Right, so those are the things that I'd like to study: scaling limits of lattice trees and scaling limits of critical percolation clusters, either unoriented or oriented. And the limit is going to turn out to be described well in high dimensions by super-Brownian motion. So now what I would like to do is to give you an introduction to super-Brownian motion. Let's see if I can find my clock here. Yeah, so how do you construct super-Brownian motion? Well, what I'm going to be talking about is usually called the canonical measure or the excursion measure of super-Brownian motion. That's really the only thing that I'm going to need for this talk. And this is how it's constructed. You start with a critical branching process. It's one of these Galton-Watson branching processes, which has been around for a long time. This process works as follows. You start with a single individual that has a random number of offspring. There's some distribution that says what the offspring distribution will be. Then the offspring independently have their own offspring according to this same distribution, and so on. You generate a family tree in that way. The fact that it's critical is to say that the expected number of offspring of any one individual is exactly equal to 1. Okay, if that expected number of offspring is less than 1, then the process is certainly going to die out, because it just can't reproduce itself. And if the expected number of offspring of any individual is greater than 1, then there's going to be a population explosion, and you'll see some kind of exponential growth. We're interested in the critical case where the expected number of offspring is exactly equal to 1. Now, it's an old result from the 30s of Kolmogorov, I'm not sure exactly, but I think Kolmogorov was involved in that a critical branching process dies out. So with probability 1, it's going to die out in finite time. Well, we're interested in looking at the very long family trees there that live for quite a large number of generations. And so what we'll do is we'll condition the process to survive for at least n generations, where n is some large number. So we're just going to only look at those family trees that live for a long time. Then what we'll do is we'll randomly embed that family tree into the lattice. And I've got a picture of it here somewhere I want to show you. This is another low-tech picture. Okay, so my family actually here is going up rather than down. So this is the family tree here, and we're conditioning it to live to some large time n. Typically, when that happens, the mass of this tree, the number of individuals in the entire family tree, is going to be about n squared, with about n individuals per slice. And then we're randomly going to embed that into n to the minus 1/2 times zd, in such a way that the root, the ultimate ancestor here, gets mapped to the origin in zd. And these connections here, these edges in this graph, get mapped to nearest neighbor bonds in the lattice. So you'll end up with something that looks perhaps like this, where I've also rescaled time from n generations to 1 generation in this picture. Then we're going to let n go to infinity. And then what happens basically is that each path that you see here gets transformed into some Brownian motion. I've drawn it in such a way that these Brownian motions here are avoiding each other, but that's only for so that you can see what the picture looks like. You should really imagine that these Brownian motions are bumping into each other all over the place. But then the picture would just look like a big blob. Right, so that's what we do. We start with this critical branching process. We condition it to live for a very long time. We randomly embed the family tree into the lattice where the lattice spacing has been scaled according to n in a particular way. Then we're going to assign mass 1 over n to each of the embedded vertices and let n go to infinity. Now, when you do that, what you end up with is something quite remarkable. It's a measure-valued Markov process. It turns out that the right language to use in order to describe this is measures, that the state of the system at some fixed time here should be regarded as a measure on RD, which is just the mass distribution of those individuals that happen to be alive at that time after the scaling has and the limit has been performed. That measure is almost surely supported on a set of Hausdorff dimension 2, if we're in high enough dimensions, above two dimensions. And if you project this entire range of this super Brownian motion cluster here onto RD, then you end up with a measure which is almost surely supported on a set of Hausdorff dimension 4. So I think I've just maybe stated what some of the properties of this process are. The state space is finite measures. It's a Markov process on finite measures. The range of super Brownian motion cluster like this is a finite measure on RD, which is almost surely supported on a set of Hausdorff dimension 4. That's what I just said a moment ago. The total mass of the range is going to be a random variable. Okay, how it's a finite measure, but what is its mass? It's going to be a random variable. It depends on the particular family tree that you happen to be looking at. And what we might do is condition that total mass, so I'm thinking about the projection of this picture down onto RD here, condition it to have total mass 1. Actually, there's a self-similarity there, which means that if you study the mass 1 clusters, you're actually looking at everything else at the same time. That's called ISE, or integrated super Brownian excursion, and that is a random probability measure. A lot is known about this. It's a hot topic in probability. If you look at Annals of Probability, you're bound to find articles about super Brownian motion, or more generally, these measure-valued processes. And I've made a list here of some of the names of people that have influenced us as outsiders to the subject. Particularly, Aldous was the work of Aldous was very important for us to understand that ISE should be the limit of lattice trees, the scaling limit of lattice trees in high dimensions. You know, back, say, almost 12 years ago, Hera and I had proved some theorems about high-dimensional lattice trees, which led us to believe that we should be able to construct the scaling limit, but we were faced with this problem that we didn't know what the limit was. We didn't know what kind of an object we were looking at. And it was Aldous who pointed out to us, he pointed it out to everybody in an article that he wrote and conjectured that the scaling limit should be ISE. So here's the result for lattice trees. I'll be talking about both the nearest neighbor model, where the trees are constructed out of nearest neighbor bonds, and also the spread out model, where these longer bonds are used, where there's this parameter L, which tells you how big of a bond you're allowed to use when you're building your tree. And this is part of the PhD thesis at McMaster University of Eric Derbez. So for the nearest neighbor model, in very high dimensions, or for the spread out model with dimension greater than 8 and L sufficiently large, then the scaling limit is ISE. And here the space is scaled down by 1 over the 4th root of n, which is consistent with this 4-dimensional nature of ISE that I mentioned. That's why that 1/4 is connected to that 4-dimensional nature. The reason for looking at spread out models is that in the nearest neighbor model, the method of proof uses the inverse dimension as a small parameter. It's a perturbation argument. And this sort of obscures the role of the dimension. It has to be big in order to make some expansion converge. Instead of doing that, we'd like to really see d greater than 8 coming out, because 8 really is the right value here. It's the right dimension above which we should expect to see ISE. In lower dimensions, we don't expect any kind of a Gaussian limit to come up. And the nearest neighbor, the spread out model was introduced in order to be able to see the role of d greater than 8. Then 1 over L becomes the small parameter. So as I say, a different limit is expected for d less than 8. It's really not understood. There's no SLE version, which is going to work for the lattice tree model. The dimension 8 shows up as 4 plus 4 here. 4, remember, for self-avoiding walk was 2 plus 2. Here it's 4 plus 4. And the idea is that the ranges of two independent super Brownian motions will not intersect each other in more than 8 dimensions, because they're four-dimensional objects. Two four-dimensional objects typically won't intersect in more than 8 dimensions. And so you can build a tree basically by starting with a small tree and sticking a large tree onto it, and you're not going to create cycles very much if you do that, because these two trees, being four-dimensional, don't want to intersect each other anyway. So it's a hand-waving argument, but it's one that gives the right answer, and you hear this kind of argument a lot. So what is the result for ordinary percolation? It's going to be stated in terms of two-point function and three-point function. So the two-point function is the probability that two points are connected here, 0 and x, within a cluster of size n. So this last equation here is saying that the connected cluster of the origin, the sites that can be reached to the origin from paths consisting of occupied bonds, has size n, n such sites. So this is the probability that 0 is connected to x and that 0 is connected to exactly n sites. That's the two-point function. The three-point function is the probability that 0 is connected to x, it's also connected to y, and that the size of the cluster is equal to n. With Hara, we proved the following theorem recently. It starts with talking about the nearest neighbor model in very high dimensions, much bigger than 6, and we're taking p equals pc. As you remember, as I said before, we're interested in the scaling limit of critical percolation clusters, so we're going to fix p to be equal to pc. Then what the theorem says is that the scaling limit of the two-point function up there and of the three-point function are the same as the two-point function and the three-point function for ISE. I won't write down what those functions are, but these are functions which were written down in the paper of Aldous that was so helpful to us. And here space is being scaled by n to the 1/4, so we should think about this x as being on scale n to the 1/4 here, and similarly for y. So that's pretty convincing, I think, that ISE is underlying critical percolation clusters in high dimensions. In order to see the role of 6 dimensions, we looked at the spread out model, but there we weren't able to get quite as strong results. I won't state exactly what the result is, but just simply say that there's a weaker link with ISE for the spread out models for d greater than 6 and L sufficiently large that can be proved with the same methods. So one way of summarizing this, it actually goes a little bit beyond what it is that I've said, but I think it's still true, that the scaling limit of the incipient infinite cluster, the IIC, is this ISE, integrated super Brownian excursion for d greater than 6. Because as I was pointing out before, when we look at the scaling limit of these large critical percolation clusters, we're getting our hands on the incipient infinite cluster. Now, 6 is equal to many things, but including 4 plus 2, and that turns out to be the right way to understand this critical dimension 6 for ordinary percolation. It's not apparent from what I've said so far that this is really the reason that 6 emerges, but what turns out to be important in the proof is, when does the range of an independent super Brownian motion avoid the range of a Brownian motion? Okay. For the lattice trees, it was two super Brownian motions that should avoid each other. For the self-avoiding walk, it was two Brownian motions that should avoid each other. For the percolation, it's somewhere in between. And these two objects will typically not intersect each other if d is greater than or equal to 6. So it's a four-dimensional object avoiding a two-dimensional object. Now, with Hara and with Remco van der Hofstadt, we recently proved the following theorem, which is related to the kind of things I've been talking about here. It's more connected with critical exponents, which I haven't really been emphasizing at all in this talk, but really turn out to be an important part of the whole story. And here we're looking at p equals pc and asking for the probability that 0 is connected to x. And I'm not fixing the size of the cluster at the moment. I'm just asking for a connection between 0 and x at pc. and thinking about how that decays as x goes to infinity. If p is less than pc, it turns out to decay exponentially fast, and if p is greater than pc, it converges to a constant, a non-zero constant. At pc, it behaves like a power law, which is 1 over x to the d minus 2. That's for the spread out model with L large. Hara has a related result for the nearest neighbor model if d is very large. And the reason why I'm mentioning this now is that it's input for a theorem by Eisenman, actually, which came before we proved this. Eisenman assumed the result of the statement up there for the critical two-point function and said, assuming that, let's consider the following problem. Take a box of size 1 meter by 1 meter by 1 meter in d dimensions and do percolation inside that box with a very small lattice spacing, with A equals 10 to the minus 8 meters. And just sort of stand back and look at a typical configuration and ask yourself, how big is the largest cluster that I see in the box? And about how many such clusters are there? Well, subject to that assumption up there, which is now a theorem, Eisenman proved that the largest clusters in the box have size n, which is about equal to 1 over A to the power 4. A is the lattice spacing. And that there's a lot of them. There's a to the 6 minus d of them. This is for d greater than 6. So a to the 6 minus d is a very large number. Now, the reason I mention this is because this corresponds to a lattice spacing a equals n to the minus 1 fourth, which is the same scaling that we've just seen as being relevant here for the scaling of the critical percolation clusters. And this is all happening at p equals pc, this Eisenman result. So it sort of opens up the question of whether the large clusters which are visible inside this box at PC are really just a bunch of super Brownian motion clusters. And it raises an interesting open question of how do you actually study a whole sort of gas or a whole sea of these super Brownian motion clusters in the context of percolation. But that has not really been investigated seriously. All right, here's the result for oriented percolation with van der Hofstadt. It's for spread-out models. We didn't look at the nearest neighbor model. Consider spread-out models, and here with d plus 1 greater than 4 plus 1. So I'm writing it as d plus 1 for d spatial dimensions plus the 1 time dimension in this oriented model, which I described earlier. And I'm considering the spread-out model with d greater than 4 and L very large, and I'm taking p equal to the critical value. And I want to consider the configurations in which the cluster of the origin survives to time n. So these are not very likely because the probability of seeing an infinite cluster is going to be zero at p equals pc, but we're really looking at those rare events where the cluster extends to a very large time n. And then we look at the scaling limit of the two-point functions like this probability that zero is connected to xn, or the three-point function where we add additional points that need to be in the cluster of the origin, or any number of points that you like. So we're not talking here about the r-point functions for all r greater than or equal to 2. If we look at the scaling limit of that with space scaled by a multiple of 1 over square root of n, then we end up with super Brownian motion again. So here's the same kind of statement that we saw a minute ago for unoriented percolation. The scaling limit of the incipient infinite cluster is super Brownian motion for d greater than 4. Here, 4 shows up as 4 plus 0. It's also 2 plus 2. You can think about it that way as well, but the idea is that what turns out to be important in the proof of this result is that we're interested in working in dimensions where the graph of an independent super Brownian motion does not intersect the graph of a Brownian motion. So we're not talking about the ranges, as was the case for ordinary percolation, but now we want a space-time collision. And that turns out not to happen if d is greater than or equal to 4. In fact, that's a theorem of Barlow and Perkins, that for d greater than or equal to 4, there will not be any intersections. And so that leads to the idea of 4 equals 4 plus 0. How is that? Well, you have this is a really hand-waving argument, even more hand-waving than the ones that I had before, and I need both hands for it, in fact. So you have a super Brownian motion going up like this and Brownian motion going up like this, and they're going up together, and you want them to not collide. You take a leap of faith and say, well, since they're both moving, it's really only the relative motion that's important, and you can regard the Brownian motion as just being fixed and the super Brownian motion is moving. If you regard the Brownian motion as fixed, then it's just a single point, that the range of the super Brownian motion has to avoid. So that means a four-dimensional object does not intersect the zero-dimensional point, and that will happen above dimensions 4 plus 0. Okay, so those are the results. And what they show is that in these three models, lattice trees for d greater than 8, critical percolation for d greater than 6, critical oriented percolation for d greater than 4, super Brownian motion shows up in the scaling limit of these objects. Here's... Yeah?
The arc point functions there are different times and space.
That's right. Yeah. They can be at the same time, if you like, but they don't have to be. Here are some related results which were proved using very different methods than the ones that I've talked about so far. Well, I haven't talked about my methods actually yet. That'll be the next topic. But using very different methods, Durrett and Perkins, and Cox, Durrett, and Perkins have looked at the contact process and the Vohter model. So the contact process is a kind of a continuous time version of oriented percolation, which I won't define precisely. But what they showed was that if you look at a version of this spread out model in which the range of the interaction actually diverges to infinity as time goes to infinity, then they get super Brownian motion for all dimensions d greater than or equal to 2 for the limit of these critical objects. It would be interesting to look at the finite range situation for the contact process, in which case super Brownian motion should only show up for dimensions greater than 4. And there's been some work of Akira Sakai, who's a postdoc here, that I think would be a good basis for exploring that question. So with Cox, Durrett, and Perkins also looked at the Vohter model, and there with finite range, and showed that super Brownian motion is the scaling limit there for all dimensions d greater than or equal to 2. So really, the main point of this lecture is that super Brownian motion really is out there in these models. It's the right limit in high dimensions for these models, and the low dimensional situations are still pretty wide open. So I just want to end up, I only have about my watch is different than that one, so I have about 8 or 9 minutes left, and I'll talk about the method there that is used to prove all of these theorems that I've been emphasizing. So lace expansion, it was an invention of Bridges and Spencer, who first applied it to self-avoiding walk, and here's how it goes. So you let Cn of x be the number of n-step self-avoiding walks from 0 to x. So you're in the d-dimensional, let's talk about the nearest neighbor lattice, just for the sake of definiteness. And let Cn of x just count that number. How many paths are there with no self-intersections that go from 0 to x? Then if you want to ask for the probability that an n-step self-avoiding walk starting at the origin ends at x, it's just going to be the Cn of x divided by some normalization factor, which is just the Fourier transform of Cn of x. It's the sum over x of Cn of x. So that's what the Cn hat of 0 is equal to. So if you want to study this kind of a probability, it's good enough to study the numerator, because then you'll understand the denominator as well. And so let's study the numerator. And the basic idea, this is not the way it was first explained by Bridges and Spencer, who used some graph theoretical terminology which led them to introduce this name lace expansion. There won't be any laces in what I have to say, but what I'm saying is actually equivalent to what they did. You use inclusion-exclusion. So introduce this function d of x, which is just the indicator function for whether your x is a neighbor of the origin or not. So it's going to be equal to 1 for the neighbors of the origin, and it'll be equal to 0 for everybody else. Then you can decompose Cn of x in this way. It's just counting how many paths there are from 0 to x that are self-avoiding. What we'll do is, first of all, take a step somewhere to some y, which is a neighbor of the origin. This represents just a single step. And then start a self-avoiding walk from y that'll end at x, taking n minus 1 steps. That's more than the left-hand side, because now this red walk is allowed to go to the origin. And on the left-hand side, we don't want any returns to the origin because the walk's supposed to be self-avoiding. So we have to subtract off some quantity which is going to count exactly, it'll exclude exactly the stuff we included here that we didn't want. And that can be drawn pictorially like this. So all this represents is the number of n-step walks which start at 0 and end at x and which are self-avoiding, except they have to come back to the origin exactly once. All right. Then you use inclusion-exclusion again. You're going to overcount and then remove what you overcounted by. So here, we'll write this tadpole here by saying, let's overcount by removing the interaction between this loop and this line. These are forced to avoid each other now. Let's forget about that. That'll give us this term here, which count this UM as the number of polygons of size M. And that's the loop there. And then there's that tail, Cn minus M of X, and that's written here pictorially with the blue and the red to indicate that we're making these parts of the walk independent of each other now. Well, they were obliged to avoid each other on the left-hand side, so we should subtract off what we overcounted by, and we'll then be subtracting off the number of configurations where the red walk hits the blue walk, and that looks like this. And then you keep on going like this using inclusion-exclusion to sort of separate the interaction, remove the interaction from the tail and the other more compact part of the diagram, and do this in a systematic way. What it leads to is this convolution equation, where there's some quantity pi, which is given by diagrams in this way. So there is a precise way of writing down what these diagrams mean. I'm not going to emphasize that now because I don't really have much time, but these are counting things. They're counting certain kinds of configurations. And what you can do is for d greater than 4, you can control the size of this pi. It turns out to be a small perturbation of the first term. And you can analyze this equation either by using induction on n or by using generating function methods to analyze the series. And that's the way that the proof goes. So I'm sweeping a lot under the rug there, but that's the basic idea which underlies the Lace expansion. In the time that's left, I want to just indicate briefly how that kind of approach might be generalized to situations where you have branching, which we really need to do if we want to study these lattice tree and percolation models that I've been talking about. So for lattice trees, let Tn of x be the number of n-site lattice trees which contain the specific sites 0 and x. This is the kind of thing that we want to study. Picture such a tree as a backbone with branches, right? If it's a tree and it contains 0 and x, so there's a unique path in the tree which goes from 0 to x. That's the backbone. And then along that backbone, you see a lot of branches, which are, they have to avoid each other because they're not allowed to form any kind of cycles. So we want this to be a tree. So there's quite a strong interaction, a repulsive interaction between these branches. But we can do the same kind of inclusion-exclusion that was used previously. That is, to leading order, we'll say, well, at least in high dimensions, probably this first branch doesn't want to intersect any of those other branches anyway. So let's approximate Tn of x by the number of branches at the origin of some size times the number of trees which go from a neighbor of the origin off to x, and then we have to sum over the possible sizes of the trees. That's what the sum over m does. And then subtract off the configurations which we included here, which we don't want, which are going to be configurations where this first branch actually intersects one of those later branches. And so schematically, that's configurations that look like this. It's like a lattice tree, except some later branch along the backbone has to come back and intersect the first branch. And then we're going to use inclusion-exclusion again to sort of turn off the interaction between this part of the tree, or this object, and the rest of it. So we'll make them independent and then subtract off a correction. And schematically, the correction is going to look like this because it's going to involve configurations where the red stuff sends off a branch which intersects a branch from the blue stuff. So you just keep on going like that, and you end up with, I'll put it over here, you end up with a convolution equation which looks very much like the convolution equation that we had over here for self-avoiding walk. The difference is in the pi. The pi will now involve different kinds of configurations than what was seen previously for the self-avoiding walk. And so it turns out that the role of the critical dimension shows up in the analysis of this pi. These can be understood in terms of Feynman diagrams, and you need dimensions greater than 8 in order to make those Feynman diagrams converge. For percolation, I'll just talk about ordinary percolation here. This is my last transparency. The expansion is for the two-point function, that is, the probability that 0 is connected to x. We're interested primarily when p equals pc, but the expansion works more generally. And you want to introduce some kind of a linear structure in the percolation cluster, the way that we had for the self-avoiding walk, or for percolation, or for lattice trees, the way that we were able to introduce a linear structure by looking along the backbone. Trouble is that a percolation cluster is not a tree, so it doesn't have a backbone the same way that a lattice tree does. But what we do is we look for these red bonds in the cluster. These red bonds are the bonds, pivotal bonds, they're called, so that they're occupied bonds whose removal from the cluster would disconnect 0 from x. And in high dimensions, there's a lot of pivotal bonds. And so in between the pivotal bonds, there's some more compact object. There's some double connection in between the pivotal bonds. I'm assuming I've drawn all the pivotal bonds there, so in between them there aren't any. So there must be some double connections. And they have all kinds of complicated things going on in them like this, which I don't write down in much detail. But the idea is to think of this as a string of sausages. Think of the cluster as a string of sausages. And this gives you the linear structure that is needed in order to try to reproduce what I was talking about before in the other expansions. There's a repulsive interaction in these sausages. Sausages have to avoid each other, because if they actually bump into each other, then the red bond that was between them isn't going to be pivotal anymore. So there's a repulsive interaction, and you employ inclusion-exclusion again. This time it's harder, because this is a more probabilistic model than those combinatorial models I was talking about before, but you can do it. And this time pi involves different diagrams, and you need d greater than 6 in order to analyze these diagrams when you're at the critical point. So there's quite a bit of unity to the approach behind these problems. And I guess I'll stop at this point and thank you for your attention. Yes, Ed.
Is it possible to point to an obstruction that prevents you from going 3-point functions to 4-point functions, or is it just to get to be a guy off the mess?
It's not really possible to just point to it here. It's a purely technical thing, it's a long story.
I know we've had this discussion before for different models, but let me summarize. The oriented percolation model with Repco means you have finite dimensional distributions. If you view it as a stochastic process, you have a finite dimensional distribution.
Right.
So that's the way.
That's right.
Are there candidates for the continuum limits of these models in two dimensions also in these
Not for lattice trees. So the SLE is conformally invariant. And lattice trees, the physicists tell us, are not conformally invariant in two dimensions. So it doesn't fall into that category. But critical percolation does. And actually, I had written it on the transparency, but I forgot to mention the very exciting fact that Smirnov proved in about February that he was able to take the scaling limit of critical site percolation on the triangular lattice. And Schramm, Lawler, and Werner had already identified, they had proved that any scaling limit that exists for critical percolation and is conformally invariant and satisfies some other properties must be SLE6. And Schramm verified all of those hypotheses that these other researchers needed, and so it's now proved that SLE6 describes the boundary between critical percolation clusters, occupied and vacant bonds in two dimensions. That is, as far as the triangular lattice is concerned. Yeah. The universality is still open.
Is there any chance that the rather elaborate calculation procedures that have been developed in quantum physics could be useful in this context?
Well, so the question was whether the elaborate calculation procedures of quantum physics could be useful in this context. And actually, we're using the elaborate calculation procedures of quantum physics here, actually. that's what these Feynman diagrams are all about. And the language is momentum space and propagators. And it really is quantum field theory methods that are being used here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any connection. I don't.
Right. All the questions are coming from your colleagues at UBC. Some of us were on leave, but. The other, I'd like to thank both NYU and Gore, late especially, for giving the talks in the final plenary session, which I think deserves some extra round of applause.
Thank you.
Both. Excellent. Before everyone runs off, one last duty I think is to thank a couple of groups of people who have worked very hard to make this such a success. One group, the local organizers, Dale Walson and Jingyi Chen. Is Jingyi here? We're recording this meeting now. A little applause for, I think, to show our sincere thanks. Thank you for all the people who organized the individual sessions, and there was a lot of work there.